The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Jeremiah Jacques, and I'll be guest hosting today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. And the program today is coming to you from the KPCG studio here in Edmond, Oklahoma. On the show today, I'd like to discuss a trend that's been picking up quite a lot of momentum over the last few years, and that is Japan's shift away from pacifism and back toward full-fledged militarism. This is something that the Trumpet magazine, under Mr. Gerald Fleury, and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, under Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, have been carefully watching for decades now. And the reason we've been monitoring this shift is because we believe that it will play a part in a violent conflict that affects millions and even billions of people. And to understand why we believe that, we first need to take a look at why Japan became a pacifist nation in the first place. We'll get to a lot of the modern developments soon, but first we have to take a look at the recent history of this exceptional and very powerful nation. So if you go back to the 1920s, Japan's economy was stagnating. And in order to inspire the people during this tough time, the Japanese leadership dusted off some ancient Japanese myths, and they began to teach these myths to the people. The people were taught that Japan was a nation of gods, racially superior to all other countries. And they were taught that the imperial family was the offspring of the sun goddess, Amaterasu Omikami. And around this time, state Shinto became the national religion of Japan, which taught those same doctrines. This religion taught the people that Emperor Hirohito was the son of heaven, this, you know, omnipotent god who is destined to rule the entire world. And these were not fringe ideas. They became fully mainstream ideas. These things were soon they became the mantras of school curricula, and they were trumpeted in pretty much all areas of Japan's civic life. In the mid-1920s, there was a document called the Tanaka Memorial, which was allegedly presented to Emperor Hirohito by Premier Baron Giichi Tanaka. And this document essentially became Japan's foreign policy from about 1927 until the end of World War II. And I'd like to read a little bit of this document. It says, quote, "The nations of the world will come to look upon our emperor, the Japanese emperor, as the great ruler of all nations," end quote. So that was the goal, total world domination. The authenticity of the Tanaka Memorial is a matter of some dispute. That's an important detail, but I think that the most compelling evidence for it having existed is that the history shows that Japan followed the strategy outlined in the Tanaka Memorial, at least in the broad strokes. This document laid out detailed military plans for Japan to conquer the entire world, and it all started with conquering China. Here's another quote from the Tanaka Memorial. "With China's entire resources at our disposal, we shall conquer India, Central Asia, and Europe. A victorious Japan will place all the white races of the world under the rule of the Son of Heaven. In order to conquer the world, we must first conquer China. If we succeed in conquering China, the rest of the Asiatic countries and the South Sea countries will fear us and surrender to us." End quote. So it's clear that a lot hinged on Japan's conquest of China. The Japanese wanted this conquest to inspire fear of Japan throughout Asia. And so the Japanese made sure that their invasion of China was ruthless and fear-inspiring. They thought that if they could make it ruthless enough, then they wouldn't have to even fight the other nations. The other nations would just hear about how terrible it had been and basically just surrender to Japan without a fight. So the Japanese really attacked China in a way that was just abnormally horrendous. In the massacre of Nanjing, for example, Japanese troops murdered more than 200,000 Chinese civilians. So that's besides the Chinese soldiers, there were 200,000 civilians. And reports say that mothers with infants, pregnant women, children, and old men and women were all tortured, bayoneted, beheaded, burned, or buried alive. There's a lot of photographic evidence of this that exists. And reports say that many women and girls were gang raped, mutilated, and killed. Others were kept around as what they called comfort women, which were basically sex slaves forced to serve the Japanese soldiers. This is hard to even talk about because it was just so brutal. But there are reports of unborn babies even being torn out from pregnant women and killed. There are reports of soldiers gouging out the eyes of children in front of their mothers. And these were not just rogue soldiers running amok, you know, ignoring orders. These crimes were well known to the military's highest officers. It was all part of a plan for world conquest. And the chief commander of the Nanjing invasion was Emperor Hirohito's uncle. So that right there shows that the evils in that massacre were committed pretty much with the royal stamp of approval. This barbarism against the Chinese people was sanctioned at high levels for the purpose of instilling fear in the nations that Japan planned to conquer next. And the Nanjing massacre was not an isolated case of savagery. Japanese troops were similarly cruel in several other Chinese cities and also in parts of Korea, the Philippines, Singapore, and other countries too. And then a look further back into history shows that World War II was not an anomalously aggressive epoch for the Japanese. There were also the invasions of Korea all the way back in the 1590s. There was the Battle of Gangkwa. There was the First Sino-Japanese War, the invasion of Taiwan, the Russo-Japanese War, and the list goes on. So Japan's military ruthlessness before and during World War II was not isolated, but the aggression may have been more brutal at that time than it was during those other epochs. And all of that ruthlessness and tenacity of the Japanese was largely driven by their belief that Emperor Hirohito was a god, destined to rule the world. This was a toxic faith. It was a toxic religion preaching racial superiority about Japanese people being gods. And this religious faith made the Japanese people feel justified in all that killing and savagery. And it also made many Japanese virtually incapable of surrendering, even in the face of insurmountable odds. In 1941, in the thick of World War II, Japan's top military leader, Hideki Tojo, issued these orders. He said, quote, "Do not live in shame as a prisoner. Die and leave no ignominious crime behind you." End quote. There were some Japanese soldiers that were taken captive, but the majority obeyed Tojo's orders. The majority of them obeyed the doctrines of state Shinto, either by fighting until they were killed or by committing suicide to avoid capture. This was also evident in the famous Japanese kamikaze pilots who would fly suicide missions, crashing their planes into American naval vessels to try to sink them. And this fanatic commitment spread even into Japanese civilians. One of the wartime mantras was, quote, 100 million hearts beating as one. So they really wanted civilians to feel like they were part of the war machine. And this ended up making the Japanese civilians also often choose suicide over surrendering. This was probably most evident on the Japanese-held island of Saipan there in the Mariana Islands. In June of 1944, when American troops started moving on to Saipan, they saw many Japanese civilians, including young mothers, clutching their infants in their arms, just flinging themselves off of the island's cliffs rather than risk being captured. And so the Americans would try to reassure these people that they wanted to help them and that they were not in any danger. But the people had been poisoned with that toxic faith, so they chose to fling themselves off of those cliffs instead. Estimates say that there were about 8,000 people who committed suicide by flinging themselves off those cliffs on Saipan. By the end of World War II, Japan had been fighting for 14 years. Almost 3 million Japanese people were dead, and millions more were injured or gravely ill. By this time, most of the population was starving, and the nation lay in ruins. But even then, soldiers and civilians generally would not surrender. Nothing short of two atomic bombs was able to finally bring an end to Japan's perverse military fanaticism. But the atomic bombs did demonstrate force and power that the Japanese had never seen and they had never expected. Really, no one in the world at this time would have ever witnessed anything with that kind of power. And modern historians believe that dropping those atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki actually saved millions of Japanese lives, just because it persuaded them to surrender. And if they had not surrendered, the Japanese still would have been defeated, but only after the Allied forces had invaded, which would have been met with armed resistance from every Japanese soldier and most civilians too. And estimates say that not only would about 1 million Americans have been killed by such an invasion, but an estimated 6 million Japanese also would have been killed. So that would have been about 35 times more casualties than there were with the 200,000 that were killed by those atomic bombs. So anyway, it's clear that it was an unusually fanatic and extreme kind of militarism that was fueling the Japanese war machine. And it was in the immediate aftermath of that tragic wartime history that the United States occupied Japan and drafted Japan's constitution. Allied powers, led by U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, wanted to ensure that military fanaticism would not rise again in Japan. We'll play a clip here from General MacArthur. This was from a historic speech that MacArthur delivered on September 2nd, 1945, from the USS Missouri, as it was anchored there in the Bay of Tokyo. This speech was given during the Japanese surrender ceremony that took place on the USS Missouri. And in this speech, MacArthur talks about the condition of slavery that the Japanese people were trapped in because of the toxic doctrines of state Shinto and of emperor worship. Here's the clip.
We stand in Tokyo today, reminiscent of our countryman, Commodore Perry, 92 years ago. His purpose was to bring to Japan an era of enlightenment and progress by lifting the veil of isolation to the friendship, trade, and commerce of the world. But alas, the knowledge thereby gained of Western science was forged into an instrument of oppression and human enslavement. Freedom of expression, freedom of action, even freedom of thought were denied through suppression of liberal education, through appeal to superstition, and through the application of force. We are committed by the Potsdam Declaration of Principles to see that the Japanese people are liberated from this condition of slavery. It is my purpose to implement this commitment just as rapidly as the armed forces are demobilized and other essential steps taken to neutralize the war potential.
So it was obvious to General MacArthur and the rest of the world that the Japanese people had really been enslaved to this fanatic wartime mentality. He talks about the condition of slavery that he was determined to liberate Japan from. And so to accomplish that liberation and to ensure that military fanaticism would not rise again in Japan, MacArthur and the other Allied officials wrote a new constitution for Japan. And they included a clause in this constitution called Article 9. Article 9 basically outlaws war as a means for Japan to settle international disputes. I'll just read the exact wording of Article 9 here. It says, quote, "Aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. In order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized." End quote. So that's some very clear language. It's inescapably clear, really. And as part of the liberation efforts, MacArthur's team outlawed emperor worship throughout Japan, and they disbanded state Shinto. The Allies wanted to root out the Japanese radicalism that had caused so much suffering throughout East Asia. So they knew that these measures, however extreme, were necessary. Many people at the time called for Emperor Hirohito to be removed from the throne. Some even said he should be tried and possibly executed for war crimes. But MacArthur had a close advisor named Bonner Fellers, who had spent his life studying Japanese culture. And Fellers explained to MacArthur that in the eyes of the Japanese people, executing the emperor would be comparable in some ways to the crucifixion of Christ. It would deify Hirohito in the eyes of the people. It would embolden the position of the militarists, and abolishing the monarchy would also just greatly destabilize Japan. So, based on this counsel, MacArthur decided not to have Hirohito tried for war crimes or killed, and MacArthur even insisted that Hirohito remain on the throne as emperor. They ended up ensuring that Emperor Hirohito deliver his famous Declaration of Humanity. This was a radio address that went out throughout Japan, in which the emperor denounced the idea that he was a god, and he proclaimed himself to be a human. And in this famous address, Hirohito also said the Japanese are not a superior race, and he renounced the nationalistic interpretation of Shinto. I'll just read a quote from his speech. Hirohito said, quote, "The ties between us," meaning the royal family, "and the nation do not depend only on myths and legends, and do not depend at all upon the mistaken idea that the Japanese are of divine descent, superior to other peoples, and destined to rule them." End quote. So that marked the first stage of a process that turned Hirohito from an absolute ruler, literally worshipped by his people, into essentially a constitutional monarch. So Hirohito's Declaration of Humanity was a landmark speech. It was a real milestone in Japanese history. And it was actually written by MacArthur's team. But that was just one other part of these rigorous efforts that the Allies made to prevent military fanaticism from rising again in Japan. It was just one other part of those efforts to liberate the Japanese from that condition of slavery that MacArthur mentioned during his speech that we heard there that he delivered on the USS Missouri. MacArthur ended up spending more than 5 years in Japan helping the defeated and destroyed country to heal, to rebuild, and to transform itself into a democracy. As one historian put it, America and the Allies, quote, "set about doing what no other occupation force had done before, remaking the political, social, cultural, and economic fabric of a defeated nation, and in the process changing the very way of thinking of its people." End quote. So it was a project of vast scope and ambition. And the transformation seemed to have been accomplished with remarkable speed. And around that same time, not too long after Article 9 was written, the United States and Japan also signed the Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security. This treaty basically codified Japan's dependence on the U.S. for its defense. It basically said that Japan didn't need a military because America would defend Japan by stationing U.S. troops near potential conflict zones in the region. Just after General MacArthur left Japan in 1951, he bestowed some of the highest possible praise on the Japanese people. Here's a clip from MacArthur's famous address to Congress, delivered on August 19th, 1951.
The Japanese people, since the war, have undergone the greatest reformation recorded in modern history. With a commendable will, eagerness to learn, and marked capacity to understand, they have, from the ashes left in war's wake, erected in Japan an edifice dedicated to the primacy of individual liberty and personal dignity. I know of no nation more serene, orderly, and industrious, nor in which higher hopes can be entertained for future constructive service in the advance of the human race.
There's no other nation in which higher hopes can be placed for the advance of the human race, MacArthur says there. That's some of the highest praise you can imagine that MacArthur gave to the Japanese people. And I think he was exactly right. The people of Japan embody many exceptionally noble and admirable traits. Their culture and technological contributions have enriched the human experience for billions of people around the globe. But here we are today, about 65 years from the time that MacArthur made that speech to Congress. And I think that if General MacArthur were still around, he would be alarmed to see that Japan, here in 2017, is marching back toward militarism. Well, we'll take a short break now, and then we'll show you that modern Japan is returning to militarism, and we'll discuss why that's concerning and what it will lead to. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm, and we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. America's status as the world's lone superpower is rapidly fading. Other nations and groups of nations are angling to fill the void. Rising in the East is an emerging power block of tremendous potential in manpower, economic heft, and military might. Its growing presence is intensifying global competition for resources and for geopolitical influence. Where will this trend lead? What does this mean for you? Biblical prophecy provides a remarkable, penetrating preview of Asia's future. Request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. This book exposes in startling detail what Russia and China are doing and will do, and how they will affect your life. Also, you'll be sent a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet looks at today's headlines through the clear light of Bible prophecy. The Trumpet will keep you up to date on the continuing rise of the powers in the East by taking a hard look at today's news and comparing it to the prophecies of the Bible. The Trumpet magazine is this world's most informed news magazine. To learn more, request a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Act today and request Russia and China in Prophecy. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Jeremiah Jacques standing in today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. This is KPCG-FM. You can listen in online at kpcg.fm. Or if you're in the Edmond, Oklahoma area, tune in at 101.3 on the FM dial. If you'd like to email the program, please send those comments our way by emailing td@kpcg.fm. We'd love to hear from you. Well, in the first half of the show, we discussed some of the tragic wartime history of Japan, especially around the World War II era, and just how dangerous and mixed up with religion and racism that wartime fanaticism was. And that's very sad history, but it's important to keep that in mind when you look at what's happening in Japan right now. And then you see that some of the sentiments that were fueling that military fanaticism remain alive today. So here we are in 2017, some 70 years since MacArthur and the other Allied powers wrote Japan's pacifist constitution. And technically, for these 70 years, the pacifist constitution, without the change of even a single comma, has governed Japanese affairs. But the truth is, during those 70 years, Japan has made some subtle but significant strides away from pacifism. The first of these came all the way back in the early 1950s, when Japan established what was called a National Police Reserve. And then in 1954, with Washington's support, Japan expanded this police reserve into the Japan Self-Defense Force, or the SDF. As the decades went by, this self-defense force, little by little, quietly and gradually, became a fully integrated, ultra-modern assemblage of land, sea, and air components that could really rival those of most any other world power. And then in 1992, Japan passed the United Nations Peacekeeping Cooperation Law, which allowed the SDF to take part in certain non-military aspects of UN missions. This meant Japanese soldiers were allowed for the first time since World War II to be stationed outside of Japan's borders. About a decade after that came the September 11th of 2001 terrorist attacks on America. We mostly think about those attacks as being a pivotal moment for America's foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, but it also became a watershed moment for Japan's military. It was a geopolitical earthquake. And suddenly, Japanese destroyers and refueling ships were out in the middle of the Indian Ocean, helping the U.S. fight in Afghanistan. Suddenly, in the Middle East, Japanese planes were flying from Kuwait to Baghdad, transporting U.S. soldiers and all kinds of cargo. In the months and years after 9/11, Japan also started acquiring weapons that really blurred the lines between what was defensive and what was offensive. And then for a Guam bombing run, Japan deployed its newest fighter jets at the time, which were the F-2s. And these were the first jets ever jointly developed by Japan and the United States. So all of a sudden, Japan's military was a relevant force in these conflicts far away from the Japanese coasts. The New York Times said that when you take all of this together, it's clear that the 9/11 attacks brought about, quote, the most significant transformation in Japan's military since World War II, end quote. Japan's march toward open and full militarization also sped up from 2004 to 2010. During those years, Tokyo sent non-combat troops to several countries. They sent them to Iraq, Indonesia, Nepal, Israel, Djibouti, Somalia, and Haiti. During that same time frame, Japan made even more moves away from being from having a military that was purely a self-defense force. It began looking to use its space program for military purposes. Its defense agency was also upgraded to become a full-fledged ministry, which gave it a greatly amplified voice in the Japanese cabinet there. And at the same time, Japan was also making huge technological advancements. It gained, for example, the capacity to fly its F-2s more than 1,700 miles without refueling. And then in its training exercises at this time, the SDF also started dropping 500-pound live bombs. So it's clear that 9/11 ended up being kind of a geopolitical earthquake that greatly boosted Japan's military capability. And then on March 11th, 2011, an actual earthquake struck. This was the infamous magnitude 9.0 Tohoku earthquake that struck Japan there, and it spawned a huge tsunami, and it also caused a severe nuclear crisis in the country. This earthquake was the biggest one in all of Japan's recorded history, and it was the fourth biggest earthquake in the recorded history of the world. And you may remember that it just had some stunning effects. It actually triggered other earthquakes as far away as Oregon in the United States and Cuba. And then all the way down in Antarctica, 8,000 miles from Japan, it ended up breaking off a piece of an ice shelf that was about two times the size of Manhattan. And even more incredibly, this earthquake permanently changed the length of a day on Earth. The way the earthquake hit, it accelerated the spin of the Earth by a little bit, so it ended up shortening the length of the 24-hour day by 1.8 microseconds. And so ever since then, our days have been a little bit shorter. So this was a really significant earthquake in geological terms, and it also sent reverberations throughout Japan's military. And throughout the Japanese people's perception of their military. In the days and weeks after the earthquake, the SDF leapt into action. They carried out all kinds of rescue operations with more than 100,000 soldiers. That was almost half of the total SDF's force, and that figure was utterly unprecedented in the post-war era to have that many soldiers working on one project. World Politics Review wrote at the time, quote, "It is no exaggeration to say that the earthquake has spurred the most significant Japanese military operations since the end of World War II," end quote. So that's kind of a theme. We keep on hearing, this is the biggest thing since the end of World War II. And then a few years later, now this is the biggest thing since the end of World War II. It just keeps on moving in that direction. Around this time, the SDF was also involved in the emergency work at the Fukushima power station. That was where the nuclear crisis was taking place. And after the emergency part of the earthquake was over, the SDF spent a lot of time clearing debris and just helping the disaster victims to resume normal life. And all of these rescue efforts And all of these other efforts drastically improved the Japanese public's perception of their nation's military forces. As you can imagine, after World War II, there was a lot of shame that the Japanese people felt in their military. And much of that lingered on throughout the decades. But that earthquake seemed to be a major turning point. And the SDF experienced its greatest public support in decades. The next big development came in 2012 when Mr. Shinzo Abe became Japan's prime minister for the second time. Mr. Abe has made no secret of his desire to return Japan to military normalization and to make its citizens more nationalistic. And in April of 2014, he successfully removed a weapons export ban that had been in place on Japan for decades. That was an embargo that prevented Japan from exporting weapons to certain countries, and so removing it was a major boon to Japan's weapons sector. And then just 3 months after that, Mr. Abe convinced the Japanese leadership to reinterpret a key section of Japan's pacifist constitution, and that was the ban on collective self-defense. For the preceding 70 years or so before that, Japanese policymakers had interpreted this section of the Constitution as something that firmly restricted Japan's forces to acting only in Japan's own defense, and never in defense of any of Japan's allies, and never in any conflict that was happening outside of Japan's immediate territory. But Mr. Abe took some steps to reinterpret that, and in September of 2015, this reinterpretation was made official. So it meant that Japan could use its large, cutting-edge military in ways that would have been unthinkable just a few years earlier. For example, today, if a U.S. ship comes under fire, Japan is legally allowed to go help it. Or if a North Korean missile is aimed at, say, an Australian ship, Japan is allowed to shoot that missile down. Or if the United Nations is involved in what's called a gray zone activity, Japanese troops are now permitted to participate. And the Japanese wasted very little time taking advantage of these new military capabilities. In November of 2016, for the first time since the end of World War II, Japan deployed armed soldiers authorized to use force overseas. There were 130 Japanese gun-carrying troops that landed in Juba, which is the capital of South Sudan. And then about a month later, those numbers increased to 350. And so as a result of that constitutional reinterpretation that Mr. Abe had spearheaded, those soldiers had a mandate that none of their countrymen had for 70 years. They were permitted to use force to protect UN staff or civilians or themselves. Tim Kelly is Reuters' Tokyo Defense and Security correspondent. And after that deployment of Japanese troops to South Sudan, he said, quote, "For Japan, it actually represents a very, very big step and a very major stride away from those seven decades of pacifism." End quote. So that was a huge step. And that landmark reinterpretation also paved the way for greater changes to Japan's constitution. Experts expect that Japan could very soon officially have first strike capabilities against potential threats. In light of Japan's wartime history that we discussed in the first half of the show, all of these steps toward reinterpreting the constitution and toward military normalization are worthy of attention, I think, and also concern. And then there's another aspect of this trend that adds quite a lot more to that concern, and that is that Japan is notorious for failing to express very much remorse for its wartime savagery. And Japan has also even revised history in many cases to downplay the crimes that it committed in the lead up to and during World War II. For example, we discussed the Nanjing Massacre in the first half, and post-war Japan has officially apologized to China for that, but those apologies have been regularly undercut by revisionist statements and statements of denial from leading Japanese voices. Back in 1990, for example, Japan's cabinet minister, Shintaro Ishihara, said, quote, "The Nanjing Massacre is a lie made up by the Chinese," end quote. A couple of years later, in 1994, Japanese Justice Minister Nagano Shigeto said, quote, "The Nanjing Massacre is a fabrication," end quote. Then in 1997, Tokyo University professor Nobukatsu Fujioka said, quote, "The Americans brainwashed the post-war Japanese into believing they had committed terrible war crimes," end quote. So those are just a few of the revisionist statements that have been made at the very highest levels of Japanese leadership, and those are worrying. For every person who goes on record to say those kinds of things, how many more are there who secretly feel the same way, but who just choose to stay quiet about it for now? It's also quite worrying to look at the history textbooks that are used in Japanese public schools. These textbooks are notorious for glossing over or whitewashing or totally ignoring Japan's wartime atrocities. Most of these books make no mention of the Nanjing Massacre, for example, or of the comfort women, or other things like that. Can you imagine how the world would react if German textbooks didn't mention the Holocaust? These omissions and revisionist approaches in Japanese textbooks are alarming because if Japanese students aren't learning this very sad and tragic history, then it means that the nation is forgetting its past. And it means new generations could be more likely to repeat it. Although the textbooks already whitewash Japan's wartime behavior, Prime Minister Abe has recently said that he wants to further beautify Japan's wartime history so that Japanese children can be proud of their past. So those textbooks already whitewash the history, but Mr. Abe says they've not gone far enough. We need to further beautify Japan's wartime history. This is it's a foreboding and a worrisome view. And adding even more to the worry is the fact that Mr. Abe is a member of the Shinto Association of Spiritual Leadership, or the SAS. The SAS is the political arm of the Association of Shinto Shrines, and one of the SAS's goals is to scrap Article 9 in the Constitution. Another of their goals is to blur the separation of religion and state in Japan. So when you consider the role that state Shinto played in Japan's World War II era fanaticism, that goal begins to look quite dangerous. And the SAS is also dedicated to educational reforms that would better nurture a love of country among Japanese youth. So this is the same kind of whitewashing of history that we spoke about with the textbooks there. SAS director Yutaka Yuzawa has gone on record saying he believes it's time for Japan to undo the changes brought about during the U.S. occupation. He said, quote, "After the war, there was an atmosphere that considered all aspects of the pre-war era bad. Policies were adopted, weakening the relationship between the imperial household and the people. And the most fundamental elements of Japanese history were not taught in the schools." End quote. So the SAS, which Prime Minister Abe is a member of, wants Japan to return to the way it was before the U.S. occupation, at least in some aspects. Prime Minister Abe is also a member of the Nippon Kaiji, or the Japan Conference. That's a nationalist lobby group that is committed to restoring lost Japanese values. Mr. Abe has also successfully stacked his cabinet with his fellow members of the Nippon Kaiji. In June of 2015, The Economist listed the following as Nippon Kaiji's primary goals. Quote, "To applaud Japan's wartime liberation of East Asia from Western colonialism, to rebuild the armed forces, to inculcate patriotism among students brainwashed by left-wing teachers, and to revere the emperor as he was worshipped in the good old days before the war." End quote. So the Nippon Kaiji doesn't want to just forget Japan's behavior before and during World War II. They actually want to paint it as Japan being a force of liberation, liberating East Asia from Western colonialism. This is an egregious example of historical revisionism. It's the opposite of what actually happened. And Prime Minister Abe is a member of this group that has this view, the Nippon Kaiji. And he's actually quite a high-ranking member of that group, and he's successfully stacked his cabinet, as I mentioned there, with his fellow Nippon Kaiji members. Right now, 10 of Abe's 19 cabinet members are also Nippon Kaiji members. University of Auckland professor Mark Mullins recently told Reuters that, quote, "Both the Nippon Kaiji and the SAS basically believe the occupation period brought about the forced removal of Shinto traditions from public space and public institutions. For them, this was authentic Japanese identity, and to be in an independent and authentic Japan again, those things need to be restored. End quote. So those are dangerous ideas, but we have to wonder, would Prime Minister Abe really endorse a return to something as, you know, arcane and archaic and superstitious as worshiping the emperor as a god? Well, a clue to the answer came back in October of 2013, when Mr. Abe became the first Japanese prime minister since World War II to participate in a ceremony at the Isa Shrine. That is the imperial household's personal shrine, and it's considered the holiest of Japan's Shinto institutions. And when Mr. Abe was there, he participated in a ceremony that entailed bringing idols to that shrine that basically represented the emperor's divine ancestry. This was a huge story in Japan. John Breen, a professor at the International Research Center for Japanese Studies in Kyoto, said the implications of Abe's participation in the Isa Shrine ceremony are enormous. He said, quote, "Without anyone blinking an eye, it became a state right," end quote. And Mr. Abe has visited the Isa Shrine several other times since then, and he often brings some of his cabinet members with him, which is a flagrant violation of Article 25 in the Japanese Constitution, which requires a separation of church and state. So it's clear that Mr. Abe and other nationalist leaders in Japan are making big strides as they work toward constitutional revision and toward a restitution of what they call Japan's lost values. These lost values were a huge part of what drove Japan's tragic wartime fanaticism. And so the efforts that we are now seeing to restore those values from no less an authority than Japan's hawkish prime minister really should alarm us. For the last couple of minutes here, I wanted to talk about what we can expect in Japan going forward. We mentioned briefly Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong earlier, and he actually talked quite a lot about Japan's future during his ministry. Back in 1971, for example, when Japan was still very pacifistic, Mr. Armstrong predicted that Japan would awake from its post-war slumber and return to militarism. He said, quote, "Japan today has no military establishment, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly." End quote. That was in the March 1971 Plain Truth. And for decades, Mr. Armstrong's forecast could have seemed alarmist, maybe to many Japanese people and to students of geopolitics. But now, as we see Prime Minister Abe and other nationalists dismantling Japan's pacifist architecture and spearheading a revival of all of that nationalism and militarism and even emperor worship that made Japan an unusually ruthless military force, now Mr. Armstrong's forecast no longer appears far-fetched. It's clear now that Mr. Armstrong was right. He was right about that because his view was informed by specific Bible prophecies. Sometimes we'll hear journalists and others mention the biblical word Armageddon, found in Revelation 16:16. But it's very rare to hear talk of what is discussed just a few verses earlier in that same chapter. In verse 12, it mentions the kings of the east. And if you study into those passages, it's clear that these kings of the east will be a massive block of Asian nations that pool together their military strength in the end time. They do this in order to confront another power block led by Germany. And Revelation 9:16 says that the Asian army, these kings of the east, will be comprised of a jaw-dropping 200 million soldiers. A lot of the specific details of how this Eastern superpower will form in the end time are still unknown, but prophecy is clear that it will be led by Russia and that China will have sort of a secondary leadership position. And then Ezekiel 38, verse 6, says that two peoples called Gomer and Togarma will also be part of this power block. These are ancient names for the main peoples that make up modern-day Japan. So when we see Japan today making moves away from pacifism and back toward militarism, each of these moves can be viewed as a step closer to that 200 million man Asian army. Each one is a step nearer to that unprecedentedly violent future conflict that those kings of the East will take part in. So Japan's march toward militarism does point to a dark future, but there's incredibly good news also tied directly to all of this. Those same Bible books that we mentioned also include promises that God will protect any individuals, whether they're Japanese or Chinese or Korean or American or any other nationality, who repent and turn to Him. And the hope extends beyond just physical protection in the near term. God has a magnificent plan that involves opening up eternal salvation to most every human being who's ever lived. To understand these prophecies in detail, and to understand just the urgency, but also the hope that they contain, please visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. This is a free booklet, and it contains, there's a whole chapter in there about Japan, and it contains a lot of potentially life-changing information. So if you don't have a copy of Russia and China in Prophecy, please visit thetrumpet.com and order one right there. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG FM, 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available all around the world just by typing kpcg.fm into your internet browser. And please send us your feedback, your questions, and your comments to our email address. It's td@kpcg.fm. Well, thank you for joining us today, and please tune in and join us again on Monday when Richard Palmer will be guest hosting again for what is sure to be another exciting episode.